Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is the 12th of October and this is episode 81. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. A huge show.
In terms of actual length as well.
Yes, exactly. So that would, like, people would already know because I've downloaded the show and seen the extended length.
That's
but
true.
We got a very good interview with Greg Sheridan,
yep.
Foreign editor at The Australian, author of the new book, God is Good for You. We're going to be talking about the book, a lot of the themes that came out of it. Really good stuff. And if you know, a lot of Christian stuff and Christianity. And, you know, I'm agnostic. I love the conversation. So don't think if you're like listening to it going like, oh boy, I don't want to hear about God for half an hour. I loved it.
We talk about the universe.
Yes.
And meaning.
And feelings. Which,
it's pretty deep actually for us.
Yeah.
So
this is a bit of a thinky episode. We don't, like, because we also have Scott Hargraves.
Let's dumb
it down a bit. Yeah, yeah. Let's. I feel I'm about to be caught out at any second.
Yeah.
We also have Scott Hargraves on the show, Deputy Executive Director here at the IPA and Editor of the IPA Review. New IPA Review, it's going to be hitting mailboxes next week. So just a few sneak previews of some of the articles that people can look forward to. I say it here and I say it again later in the show. I'll say it here. It's good. No. So I'll say it here and I'll say it again later in the show. The IPA Review is only available to IPA members. So if you do listen to that Scott interview and you're like, damn, I want to read these articles. They sound awesome because they are. You can only get them if you're a IPA member. And Nina, she'll tell you in about 15 minutes time how you can be an IPA member.
She's real pumped.
This is a loose show already. Let us talk about it. Big news today, Pete.
Yeah, okay.
Is religious discrimination. So this story had about 15 different ways of getting out. So some, like, Fairfax got wind that there was a report on religious discrimination, and there was like, they immediately just said, well, can schools expel kids for being gay? Like, that was like the first port of call.
It was quite late, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's like, okay, there's a report. What is the absolute worst thing we can think of that would happen?
Yeah.
I mean, That to me was a weird thing to lead off. Like, there's a really interesting debate about religious discrimination. And then when you jump over, like, this hypothetical thing that has never happened and never would happen, what if it happened? Mm. Like, that seems a bit out of control.
Yeah, just as a bit of context, it's a review into religious discrimination after the same-sex marriage ordered by the Turnbull government. They've actually had the report since May last year and they've been holding on to it, but Fairfax got it,
yep,
this week. So it's in the wake of that. That's the context.
Yeah, and moments before we hopped into the studio, Fairfax released all the recommendations that the report was going to say. So yep, there was a whole thing of like, oh, the Morrison government should release the report so we know what we're dealing with, especially before the Wentworth by-election. So that just got reviewed, and I have here an advanced copy of the IPA's media release, which will be out by the time the listeners listen to the show. Unless something's gone terribly, terribly wrong, but no, it is out. I just remember getting the email before we walked in. Sorry, about what the IPA thinks of it, because the number one thing, and John Roscombe said this on the day that the Fairfax stuff got out, the second you start expanding 18C to cover religious discrimination, the second you bring in new laws that would stop people discriminating from people against religion, that's a blasphemy law.
Yeah, that is a blasphemy law. An important point about that you have to remember is, though, that most states already have them.
Yeah.
Like, if you think, wow, it's crazy, Australia would have blasphemy laws in 2018, I've got use for you.
Yeah, they're already there. And, yeah, so, Pete, I know you circled a few parts of the media release that you wanted to read out.
I did. So, basically, this is from Morgan Begg, who works here.
Foe of the program.
Yep.
Most people are friends. Morgan's certainly a foe.
Yeah, Morgan's a foe. I won't read the whole thing, but he says, you know, essentially this approach to faith-based schools creates a de facto government licensing of religion. It places the decision about permissible religious expression and doctrine in the hands of the state.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can go read that on our website. And just to expand on a point I've made on this podcast before, we have the Liberal Party leadership spill. We think, can the Liberals get back to their roots? Can they start talking about things the Liberals care about? So we started with gender quotas, and we're now at more laws to stop freedom of speech. So it sounds like they really learned their lesson just in time for the next election.
That's right.
Cool. So what else happened this week, Pete? What did you say?
Well, we saw from the ALP a suggestion, which we were a fan of, Senator Kimberly Kitching. Sorry, shouldn't make fun of people's names.
Especially when we're about to praise them.
Which Labor senator put forward a suggestion to create a bipartisan group to defend Western liberal democratic values, to discuss policy and ideas and try and influence the political agenda. And this was meant to be a group across the parties, bipartisan, Corey Bernardi, David Lanehelm, Eric Abetz, Andrew Hastie, and Conchita Fioraventi-Wells, apologies for pronouncing that incorrectly, are all in support. There's others that are in support as well. I won't go through them all. Victorian Liberal MPs Tim Wilson and James Patterson,
friend of the program,
both used to work at the IPA, were very cheeky. They're cheeky guys, and they said they would support the group if Labor MPs would also support the group, which of course they knew probably won't happen. There was someone who said, I'll just get this person's name, Labor Senator Jacinta Collins, who is a social conservative, who said she would consider joining the group. She said discussions around our Judeo-Christian heritage and the extent to which some have been prepared to acknowledge that has probably drifted in recent times, except for some of these Institute of Public Affairs and Liberal Party narrow discussions. So it would be fruitful to broaden that out. We can be broad.
We're very broad.
Let's broaden it up.
I would say the comedy of this program is extremely broad.
Exactly. Everyone loves it. Yeah. So let's get broad. We're fine with that. So
absolutely. Yeah, it's a cool thing because you know, like there's a lot of Labor Party upper leadership that are really getting into identity politics and a lot of all of these stuff and, you know, the gender quotas thing. And you do think there's a lot of Labor voters who are like, you know, identity politics, that's not doing it for me. They would appreciate a return to like talking about Western civilization.
Yeah, yeah. And ideas like free speech and democracy. And the
rule of law.
That's not a right-left thing.
No. You know, that's, well, apparently it is, but like, yeah.
So, you know, it shouldn't be one side talks about it and one side doesn't. They should just be accepted as givens.
Yes.
Well, I mean, not beyond. Anyway, go on.
That's the point.
Topic done.
Topic done. We'll move on to another one. So, another big report that got all around the world this week. IPCC, they've come out, they've said, I think we've got about 10 years to save the planet.
Mm.
I think that was the idea.
I'm not sure exactly how many years they gave us, but
yeah, it's always like some arbitrary number of years they have to save the planet. But it was like the idea that, you know, the whole world needs to change how they approach energy.
Yep.
I think Adam Bandt said, we're screwed if we don't get rid of coal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like the classic thing. Like, we used to do this all the time. It's been a while since our last proper global warming freakout.
There was the 4 years by the Prince.
4 years.
Remember that when we celebrated?
Yeah. So I don't know what the IPCC is doing because it's already too late.
Yeah, the world has already ended.
Yeah.
So.
This is all a hologram.
Yeah. This is all a figment of Nina's imagination.
Nina, what a terrible imagination you have.
I know.
Okay, so my point with this is, as always, it's like this. This alarmist thing, it gets headlines and it says, okay, we've got 10 years. Okay, we need to get rid of coal right now. Okay, we need to invest more in renewable energy. And it always comes back to the Bjorn Lomborg thing of slow down. Would doing any of this actually have a cost-benefit analysis?
Yep.
You talk about like, and we're about to talk about the Nobel Prize. Humans have had the ability to adapt to innovate in terms of dealing with the climate and making sure to mitigate matters. So we don't need to destroy all of our coal-fired power stations right now.
That's right.
Leave so many people in poverty.
That's right. We have to think about the cost of doing that. Of course, we talked about a few weeks ago what that would mean. Now, this fellow's name, finding it hard to find names today. Dr. Pep Kennedale from CSIRO, research scientist, said we require the almost immediate establishment of a global carbon market. So he obviously missed our podcast a couple of weeks ago.
What?
Maybe listened to
Pep,
it and
come
forgot
on, bud.
Maybe it just slipped his mind. Maybe the music he was listening to was on too loud or something at that time. That 78 million people would be put into risk of hunger, according to this research that Bjorn Lomborg talks about. As a result of a global emission trading system, 24 million would be pushed into hunger as a result of climate change left untouched, according to Bjorn Lomborg, by 2050.
Yeah.
So
the weirdest thing for me is always like, there's this whenever a report like this comes out, there's the immediate thought of like people that go like, oh my God, what a terrible thing. It's like, I can't believe governments are so blind to it. And also governments are the only things that can stop it.
Yeah.
Like why are like, they both the enemy and the hero at the same time?
Yeah.
Like Schrodinger's government.
I haven't got an answer for you, James.
Well, I want one by the end of this podcast. I'm going to touch base with you again.
And of course, humans always predict their own demise. Someone sent through to me a list of these Armageddons that were meant to be coming. And the first one was in 1864.
Yeah.
And I reckon it goes much earlier than that.
Oh, like people with the placard of the end is nigh have been here for thousands and thousands of years.
Yep. They didn't always get trillions of dollars of funding, but
they've
been around.
Exactly. All right. What else have we got?
So I'm doing cakes, aren't I? So the UK Supreme Court, has found that Ashes Bakery in Northern Ireland not guilty of religious discrimination for refusing to bake a cake decorated with a message in support of same-sex marriage.
Yeah.
So this is a cake shop in Northern Ireland that got, or I think a bakery, really.
Something to do with cakes.
Yeah, the production of food.
Yeah.
And they got asked to make this cake, and they got found guilty, you know, through all the court system. It was until they got to the Supreme Court that they finally got off. The reason they got off is because they were found to not be discriminating against people who were gay. They were just discriminating against a political idea, which is same-sex marriage. So on that basis, they got off. What I found interesting about this, though, that the lower courts found them guilty of sexual orientation discrimination. The district judge found them guilty of same-sex discrimination because he said that same-sex marriage was indissociable from homosexual orientation. I know people who are gay who are against same-sex marriage.
Or don't want to get married themselves. Like, yeah, that seems a very weird thing.
It's like this thing of everyone from a minority group has the same opinion.
Yeah.
Which is literally the most offensive thing you can think.
But he's a judge, Pete.
Well.
So have you considered that?
I have considered that, James.
Maybe
I should reconsider it.
Yeah, please do. So it's the classic thing of like, can you bake a cake? And the question always is like, okay, all right, so should a gay baker be forced to make a cake that's against same-sex marriage? Like,
yeah.
Once you get into those things, so like a Palestinian baker, like a pro-Israel baker have to make a Palestine cake. Like, once you get into like, oh, you have to make the cake, like that's a huge thing.
Like a cake with a Collingwood emblem on it or something.
That's a bridge no one should cross.
Where does it end?
Where does it end, Pete?
But at least this actually happened.
Yes.
Unlike the Fairfax thing.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. So we've got one more that we'll talk about at the top here. Then we get into the interviews, and we're already running a bit long. So the Nobel Prize for Economics, that got announced. Nobel Peace Prize also got announced. Trump did not get it. Really? Blow me down with a feather. But anyway, the Nobel Prize for Economics.
Was that a thing?
It's just like, because Obama won it for not being George Bush, and then Donald Trump. You know, like...
Oh, whoever's next will win it.
Oh, absolutely.
Unless it's Kanye won't win it.
That would be an electric award ceremony.
Time you guys awarded me this.
Yeah, if what he did on Saturday Night Live is any microcosm of what he'd do on the Nobel Peace Prize Committee, oh boy, hope there's a backing band. Anyway, what were we talking about? No, so Trump. Right?
I
want to say, like, the reason Trump would have got it is because, you know, this is the best North and South Korea talks have ever been.
Is that right?
Surely.
Is that our take?
Since the war, I guess.
All right, I'm not going to necessarily agree with that, but...
They were, like, shaking hands and something. Like, you thought that was on the cards, like, 5 years ago?
I will take this question on notice. We can address it next week.
Okay, cool.
Because
I want the answer to have you considered it, and I want the... Anyway, Nobel Peace Prize in Economics. This podcast is loose. All right, William Nordhaus, Paul Roma, they're joint prizes. So we featured a lot of this in Hey, What Did I Miss Yesterday, the always excellent Marginal Revolution blog. You go there if you want to read more about it. Tyler Cowen is fantastic. Yep. So he can talk to you about what they did and what they are, but basically microcosms. So Paul Roma, big on the idea that ideas drive economic growth.
That's right, James. And as someone who is almost finished an economics PhD, I am an expert on all economics. And a big thing was, you know, we've got investment. We've got, what's the other thing? Labor, capital, that's growth, right? That's what people thought was growth. But then clearly, what about ideas? Like, how do you decide what you're going to invest in?
Yeah.
You know, like maybe you're going to build a factory. Maybe you're going to start a podcast with a bunch of lovable scamps who are a bit rough around the edges but have hearts of gold. I don't know. So, yeah.
Well,
that's it. That's the thing.
I'm glad we did that. So go to Hey, What Did I Miss? If you are subscribing to that, and if you don't subscribe to it, make sure you do. Go to the IPA website and you can follow the prompts. If you want to read more about that.
Did we mention the other winner?
William Nordhaus. He does a lot of stuff about, and I think I mentioned him earlier in the show, so he does a lot of stuff about how...
Green accounting, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, green accounting. Very big fan of carbon taxes, so that might dilute a few of you listeners out there's appreciation of him.
He did. He's not all bad. He's done that, right? But he's also done stuff about how GDP doesn't quite measure our advances in, economic well-being.
Yes.
Because it's all about... Anyway, read the articles.
Yeah, very good. So we'll go to those interviews with Greg Sheridan and Scott Hargraves. I'll just run through some of the stuff that the IPA has been up to this week. So like I said, big thing today was the media release on the Religious Freedom Review. Make sure you're going reading that and read what Morgan Begg has said about it. Okay, a few other ones we got here. So we've got Daniel Wilde in The Spectator Australia. He's talking about regulators, the Royal Commission, and crony capitalism. That one was a really cool article. I really like that. He's talking about how at the base, you know, we can get outraged about all the stuff that we're reading from the Royal Commission But the problem, the heart of it is crony capitalism, which is big banks and big business and big government all conspiring together to protect each other. And, you know, the shareholders and regular punters get left out. Always love ones when the IPA has a crack at big business because, you know, everyone says like, oh, you just like big businesses making money. And it's like, well, no, if they're, you know, getting money from the government and they're all protecting each other, then that's no good.
Well, we bad corporates all the time when you think about it.
Yeah, we do. So we also have the latest episode of the Great Books of Literature podcast, episode 5, Don Quixote by Miguel de Cervantes. So if you did like Don Quixote or if you want to learn more about it, go download that. A lot of people are really liking that podcast, so make sure you guys are getting on board. I think we got number one again overnight from Don Quixote, so make sure you're getting on that. Morgan Begg, once again, Red's on the red carpet. He's talking about how there's an interesting development in Hollywood where it's no longer what does the US market want, it's about what does the Chinese market want or what do other international markets want. Which is, in turn, what do Chinese censors want? Because, you know, you need to pass the censors to get to the Chinese market.
Yeah, which is a very interesting...
Yeah, yeah. So stuff like the controversy now with that Ryan Gosling movie about the landing on the moon, and they've edited out... Well, they've written out the part where the American flag gets placed on the moon. Just think, like, if you're going to make a moon landing thing, like, that's the most iconic image, apart from, like, Stanley Kubrick filming it in the background in the lot in Hollywood. Sorry, that was too easy. Yeah. I don't actually believe the moon landing was staged.
He does absolutely believe it was staged.
I never found the Zodiac Killer, though. Where was I? Okay, next up, we've got Dr. Bella DeBrera. She's over in London now, so we miss her terribly. The left's Libra side, talking about the Horn Prize from the Saturday paper and all the problems with cultural appropriation. And you've got Matthew Lesh in the Sydney Morning Herald talking about his new book, Democracy in a Divided Australia. We interviewed him on the show a few weeks ago. If you want, make sure you're going out and buying a copy of the book. So that's it. We'll now go to those interviews. Thank you so much for listening and thank you so much for subscribing. We're available on iTunes, Podbean, Spotify. You can download it through all the places that people are downloading it. I see Pocket Cast is really popular with some of our listeners.
There's a performer performing the interpretive dance as well that goes on YouTube.
Yes, and that's just Pete in a wig. But I also saw, this was interesting. So I was looking up where people download our podcast from. One of the apps is Castro.
Really?
So the person out there is listening to this app through Castro. Find a better named app.
Well,
that's my theory. Maybe. Unless it's not named after Fidel Castro.
Maybe it's Castro's son or something.
Well, he's not that great either. But anyway, so Nina, if people want to join the IPA, if they want to get their hands on an IPA review, which we're about to preview, where can they go?
Well, just visit our website, ipa.org.au, where everything is at. Click on the join button and starting as low as $22 per year, you become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Yay. All right, let's go to those interviews now. Okay, we are now joined for the first time by Greg Sheridan, foreign editor at The Australian and author of the new book, God is Good for You, available from Allen & Unwin Publishing now. You can get it on Booktopia. You can get it on a bunch of great bookstores. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Great to have you. So this book talks about Christianity, and you mentioned that Christianity is declining in the world today. Census shows that in 2006, 64% of people in Australia identified as Christian. In 2016, that was 52%. It's a big fall. There's echoing falls in Britain as well. Why is Christianity declining?
Well, James, Christianity is declining in the West, by which I mean Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and North America. It's not declining elsewhere. It's on fire in Christianity. In China, it's doing very well in Africa, and it's full of life in Latin America. So the West is going into this very peculiar cul-de-sac of history of becoming an atheist society, not top-down atheism like Stalin's Soviet Union or Pol Pot's Cambodia, but bottom-up atheism. Now, the reasons for decline are many. They go over hundreds of years. Partly, it's a misreading of the scientific revolution, as if science makes religion obsolete. Partly, it's the long experience of affluence. You know, when it's my view that all human beings need the mercy of God, but when you're very affluent and death is hidden away in nursing homes and you're in reasonable health, you can fool yourself into believing there is no God and that you don't need God's mercy. And then on top of that, the culture has become very hostile to Christianity. So even though the culture, Western civilization, grew out of Christianity, it has become very hostile to it. So there are no signals of reinforcement or confirmation or no clues to Christianity in popular culture anymore.
Yeah, so
Oh, so why does that matter, Greg? Why is that a problem that Christianity is declining?
Well, I think it matters because Christianity is true, and if you and I think it is in the deepest element of human nature, of our DNA, to yearn for God. And if you reject God, you reject something of humanity, you know, something at the core of humanity. The other thing is, even if you don't believe anything about Christianity, Western civilization grew out of Christianity. Now, there's a paradox here because Christianity is a universal religion, so it's open to every human being, and I'm sure most Christians today are not living in any part of Western civilization. But it is also the case that our civilization and everything we like about it, human rights, feminism, environmentalism, secular government, the whole lot, all grew organically out of Christianity. Not in a repudiation of Christianity in the Enlightenment or whatever, but organically out of Christianity, as I argue in one of the chapters in this book. And if we turn our back on it, we're going to cut ourselves off from the roots of all the civic values that we believe in. Now, it's an open question about whether we can maintain those civic values while we turn against the sources of those civic values, so to speak.
So you said how this has been a trend that's been happening for a few centuries now, but I do want to bring up that stat. So 64% of people in Australia in 2006 are Christian, 2016, 52%. So that's a huge drop in a very short amount of time. So do you see any like singular event or like what the reason for that much of a drop in that short of time would have been?
It's a drop that's similar in Britain and the United States. Britain is now a majority atheist nation, and America is more religious than we are. It starts from a higher base, but you're seeing the same decline. I don't think it was a single event. I mean, it's tempting to say the child abuse scandals. I don't think that. There's very little evidence that people have left Christianity because of the scandals. I mean, people understand that Christians are human beings and do, you know, some Christians do terrible things, some Christians do heroic things. But for a long time, the culture wasn't very actively Christian, but lived off the accumulated moral capital. So we still used the moral categories of Christianity, as we still do today. Human rights, universal human dignity, come entirely out of Christianity, the Judeo-Christian tradition, and we still use those categories. But I think we've now reached a point where we're almost no longer a post-Christian society, we're really a pre-Christian society. So people can go through school and university now and never hear anything about the history or content of Christianity. So you don't know where human rights came from. The book of Genesis, God made humanity in his own image, is the most radical pro-human rights statement in the ancient world. The New Testament, where everybody has an immortal relationship with an immortal God or an eternal relationship with an immortal God, including women and slaves and foreigners, that was a radical universalism which had never been known before in the ancient world. And the development, the first statement of secular government, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. Now, all of that is completely unknown to people unless they get it through a sort of a folk idiom. The other thing is, in the 1960s, somehow or other, we lost touch with the sacred altogether. And at the same time, strange subject for an old codger like me to talk about, but the sexual revolution of the 1960s led to a culture which is hypersexualized. And that's very difficult for people to deal with. Normal people, ordinary people, find that very difficult. And then digital media, while it holds enormous promise, has also produced a whole lot of social dynamics which are hostile to Christianity. Short attention spans, an emphasis on affect, emotion, sensory gratification, the whole lot, all of which is sort of inimical to reflection and meditation, I think.
So you sort of have touched on the idea that Christianity has given us these things like feminism and liberalism and social justice and all those things, and how that's actually taken place. I went to Catholic schools my whole life and I never got that line, well, not that line, but that argument that Christianity had given us those things. So why is that? Why aren't we teaching people that that's where these things came from?
Well, your experience is really very revealing, and that's very powerful testimony. I mean, the sentence you've just said is, in a sense, more powerful than my whole book. So part of the book, although it's tries to be a positive book and it's very non-denominational, and there are lots of signs of hope, lots of reasons to be hopeful, nonetheless, part of the book is a challenge to Christian institutions and specifically Christian schools. So I've got a chapter in the book, What Did We Ever Get from Christianity, which owes a lot to the magnificent Oxford scholar Larry Siddentop and his wonderful book, Inventing the Individual. Now, he is not, I think, a believing Christian, but he argues that everything we like in modern liberalism had been thought through by about the 13th or 14th century in the Christian dialogue about the good life: limited government, representative government, human rights, human autonomy, the place of the human conscience, marriage as a reciprocal institution, women as certainly the equal of men, all human beings with an equal human dignity, and so on. And it astonishes me that Christian schools don't do two things. One, provide a systematic teaching about the content of Christianity, what Christians believe. So I've got a chapter that does that, just taking a very straightforward approach of going through the Apostles' Creed. And two, the history of Christian ideas. So I hope a lot of people will read the book and say, geez, that Sheridan is an idiot, but by God, that Tertullian whom he quotes from the 3rd century, he's really interesting. Or, gosh, I never knew St. Augustine thought this. Or, look, Thomas Aquinas has sort of anticipated the theory of evolution by hundreds of years. He didn't quite get to evolution, but he certainly got to the idea of natural processes occurring, as it were, which God set off, but which proceed in their natural way to produce changes. The very idea, experimental science. So no other civilization produced experimental science. Experimental science comes from two Christian doctrines. The idea that God is sacred and that nature is natural. So the idea that God is sacred led to people to conclude that nature would reflect the order of God. So discovering the order in nature was to discover a reflection of the order of God. But at the same time, the idea that nature itself was not sacred meant that nature was not full of capricious spirits and minor deities and wild, random unpredictability. So those two insights together led medieval scholars to try to discover the order in nature, and that was the birth of experimental science. And no other great culture produced experimental science. That emerged intimately out of Christian teaching. And isn't it weird? I mean, I'm not a critic of Christian schools. I admire them enormously, or I'm not an enemy of them, let me say that. But why didn't you hear about that at school? I have no answer to that. It's just very weird.
I would say it's entirely possible that they did say that, but Pete wasn't listening.
That is a possibility. Yeah.
I want to just talk about this, though. So you talk about how scientific experiments, that comes from Christianity. But what is it about Christianity that encourages or like permits? Because like there are other religions that would say don't question that, or don't push into that area because we already have the answers. So what is it about Christianity that allows people to do that?
Well, I think, James, that's a kind of a profound question. And it's not one I address directly in the book, but let's think it through. Christianity is the great friend of reason. And so is Judaism. You know, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, whom I'm influenced by a bit in writing this book, argues that the book of Genesis is not really a book of myth. It is a polemic against myth. So in all the early creation legends and sagas, the sun is a big deal, you know. But in Genesis, God creates light, and 3 days later he creates the sun. So the sun got a huge demotion, you know, from English Premier League to minus third division, you know. And the message of Genesis was that creation was a rational process, and that it was good, and that it was not chance, that there was an inherent order there. And then Christianity was the enemy of superstition, the enemy of paganism, the enemy of child sacrifice, all of that. And it was in favour of the life of the mind, of meditation. Even the act of worship is meditative. And it took Christians a while to work things out, but the sense that God is good and that creation is good and discovering the order in creation, that was a point of discovery. So the doctrines of Christianity are contained, if you like, in the Gospels and the Epistles, And they don't ever say, don't question, don't inquire. You know, I begin one chapter with a quote from St. Peter commenting on how difficult some things that St. Paul writes are to understand. And I thought, well, that's a good shot of encouragement that the gospel writers and the epistle writers have given to Christians for the next 2,000 years. If even the first pope couldn't understand one of the first bishops, that's quite promising. And of course, he wasn't saying he couldn't understand it. He was just saying there are many difficult truths here. There's always been a sense of mystery. I think the other thing is Christianity embraces the paradox and the fullness of humanity. So there's no simple formula. The teachings of the New Testament are very clear in some respects, but they're carried out via stories rather than just neat formulations.
One thing that struck me actually in the book, which is really interesting, is that Christianity is kind of like this, we're understanding God as we go along, like we're interpreting different things, that different scriptures and things like that. It doesn't mean like everything's up for grabs or anything like that, but it is a kind of moving feast. Would that be a fair...
Yes, I think so. I think understanding develops. So there's a deposit of faith which is unchangeable. And I think that's the Apostles' Creed. You know, I believe in God. I believe in Jesus Christ, who was crucified, died and was buried on the third day. He rose again from the dead. Now, there are modern biblical scholars like postmodernists in all disciplines who will say, well, what they mean when they said he died and rose from the dead is that he, you know, ate some smashed avocado, had a transcendent experience and felt very well later, you know. But normal people can't interpret it that way. But there is an enormous amount of mystery left to Christianity. Thomas Aquinas makes the point that belief in God is entirely rational, but it's not proven. So it's justified, but not proven. If it was proven, you wouldn't need faith. So faith always encompasses a little bit of doubt and a great deal of mystery. Many things Christianity is rather skimpy in detail on. For example, the nature of the afterlife. Islam gives you a very detailed view of the afterlife. Buddhism talks about constant regeneration in a pretty clear way. Christianity promises you paradise. Christ says on the cross to the good thief, today you will be with me in paradise. But it doesn't tell you much about it. And it's a legitimate thing for you to speculate on. And yet, on the other hand, you don't need to speculate that way. If you can be a Christian without speculation, so to speak. But the area of interpretation and speculation is enormous, if you want to.
Terrific. I'll just jump in with one more before we move on to religion and Australian politicians. And it's a sort of interesting one. You mentioned there, and you mentioned in the book, that belief in God is rational. I just wanted you to unpack that a little bit more. Obviously, the IPA is not a religious organisation, and a lot of our listeners are atheists and other religions as well. But why is belief in God rational? Because I found that a really interesting part of the book.
Absolutely. So this is not an attack on anybody's religious beliefs. I'm married to a Sikh woman and I have three Sikh sons. So as well as being pro-Jewish, I lead the pro-Sikh and pro-Jewish faction of the Catholic Church. Okay. A small but very, very select faction.
Some robust meetings.
robust meetings. And the book itself is non-denominational. It really is interested in every Christian who can assert the Apostles' Creed. And the great distinction is between religious believers and atheists. And atheists are different from agnostics. Agnostics don't know, which is perfectly sensible. Atheists hold to the religious faith of atheism. Now, there is a chapter about the rationality of belief in God. You don't believe because it's rational. Belief is an act of the will, like love, rather than an act of the intellect. But you can't believe something which outrages the intellect. And the modern culture, I think, very often is trying to bluff Christians out of their beliefs, telling them that they're ridiculous and so on. So for the purpose of this book, I read the New Atheists, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and so on. I was astonished at the thinness of their arguments, at how trivial and silly they were. Richard Dawkins insists on interpreting every word in the whole of the Bible, Old Testament and New, literally. Well, no Jews do that, no Christians do that, or hardly any. It's a tiny, tiny movement. There are all kinds of different genres in the Old Testament, poems and love songs and books of history and so on. You can't interpret them all literally. But the positive rational case for God is very powerful. Roger Scruton, in his beautiful book, The Soul of the World, puts all the classical cases for the existence of God, but He argues that really the most important evidence for the existence of God is the human experience of God. Now, atheists won't admit that as evidence because they say it's subjective. But of course, most things in life are subjective. And then there's a tremendous confusion about the nature of belief. Most rational belief is based on faith. I believe I'm the son of my parents. Why? Because they told me. So it's a rational belief, but it is a belief based on faith in them. I haven't taken any DNA swabs and they're long since dead now, so I couldn't do it anymore. So it's not a proven belief, but it's a justified belief. Then the universe is full of intuitions of God. So there's this longing for God. All of our primary desires correspond to deep realities. We feel hungry, that indicates that there's food. It's not just concrete things. We feel lonely, that indicates that there's friendship. We feel this longing for God, that indicates that there's God. There is the sheer improbability of the universe. You know, if the Big Bang had been a bit bigger, the planets would have all dissipated as gas. If it had been a bit weaker, they'd have all gone back into a black hole. It had to be just right. The development of carbon had to be just right. All kinds of mathematical equations had to be just right. It really is a Goldilocks universe. It was prepared for us. I don't think that goes anywhere near proving God, but it's an intuition for God. And the final one I'll offer you, though there are a million, is the nature of the human personality. We all feel a sense of right and wrong, and that this sense comes from somewhere outside us. Now, that may be just a delusion. It may be, but it also may be true. So I think and certainly nothing that any atheist proposes has ever really addressed any of that. You know, Dawkins says God is improbable. Well, and then he has to deal with the improbability of the universe by adopting Stephen Hawking's position that perhaps there are an infinite number of universes and we've just lucked into the right one that is good for life. So you can dispense with belief in God, which humanity has overwhelmingly embraced, but you can invent an infinite number of universes. It seems to me that's much more a leap of faith, much more magical thinking than traditional belief in God is.
Yeah, I am agnostic, but when I heard about the multiverse theory, my first reaction was, like, that's as much of a religion as anything else. Like,
yeah.
There is... Yeah, but anyway.
Agnosticism, I think, is a perfectly sensible position.
Thank you very much. Yeah, well...
He doesn't get that often, so...
Yeah, I've never been called sensible on anything. I think we might have to... Running out of time, so we might have to skip over the politicians' questions, but okay. I do want to get into... So you talk about, like, we had the stat earlier, so 64%, now 52%. You say, like, as you say, downward trend in North America, Britain, Western Europe. So what is the future looking like for Christianity and maybe the world if this fall continues?
Well, I remain very optimistic. I'm essentially an Irishman, so the situation is desperate but never serious. And the second half of the book, so the first half of the book makes all these arguments from first principles, tries to argue everything from first principles. Second half of the book is a reported half of the book, dealing with Christians and Christian movements which have some dynamism. So there are 14 serving and ex-politicians, Malcolm Turnbull, Bill Shorten and so on, who all turn out to be deeply believing Christians, and they don't talk about it much publicly in Australia, but I was immensely impressed by the depth of their knowledge and the texture of their interior lives, and much broader range of people than people might guess, you know, Penny Wong, Christina Kenneally, all kinds of folks. And then there's an examination of Christian movements. So ambient Christianity is in radical decline in the West. There's no doubt about that. But there are these fantastic Christian movements which are full of life. There's this Focolare movement, which means fireside, which embraces millions of people around the world, mainly lay people, just trying to live according to the values of the gospel. And equal numbers of men and women, but to be permanently led by a woman to... emphasise the Marian profile of leadership. I was immensely impressed with the dynamism of the Pentecostal church in Melbourne, the Planet Shakers. Booming church, thousands and thousands of young people, fabulous music, full of optimism, full of life, full of good cheer, very orthodox message. So they are doing something which Christians find very difficult. They are being culturally contemporary and relevant, but maintaining the integrity of their traditional message, which is a very hard thing to do. There's this magnificent Campion College in Sydney, the first liberal arts college in Australia. created with no government help, no resources. I was there a few days ago, 100 students on campus, a few hundred alumni already, magnificent study of the Western canon. So there are all these signs of life and many, many others. I visited Benedictine monasteries which are bursting at the seams with new young recruits, young men devoting their lives to contemplative prayer. And at the end of the book, I have a chapter arguing or offering some helpful suggestions in the way that journalists always do for bishops and other leaders of Australian Christian churches. One of which is that Christians need to conceive of themselves as a bold minority. There is no longer a consensus position in society, and if there is one, it's not sympathetic to Christianity. Maybe we were 50% at the last census, but that was a lot of that was disproportionately old folks, and few of them have already died off. I'm sure we're under 50% now, and people who actually go to church or however you want to measure active Christianity, probably 10 or 15%. But minorities shape Western societies. As long as you are self-aware as a minority, that means you'll be much more robust when you're attacked, and you can deploy your resources and make your arguments much more creatively. And also you can demand minority rights. I mean, and Christians in demanding minority rights are not just asking for kind treatment for themselves, they're demanding minority rights for the truth. Christian institutions need to be a lot more overtly Christian. People who happen to be Christian, even, God help us, rackety old journalists who've led shocking, rackety, dissolute, you know, semi-drunken lives, have got to own up to their beliefs. It is a new world, and Christians won't get there if they continue to think of themselves as representing the broad consensus of society. So that position may have been comfortable 50 years ago. It's not available to them now, and they'll have more life if they're confronting honestly the unsympathetic culture that they're living in.
Yeah, so is that what you mean when in the book you say churches, just want to get the right words here, so churches have to not be afraid to be controversial. Is that what you're sort of saying? Is
absolutely.
That,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is a passage in the Gospel, and I, as a secular journalist, a foreign editor, I don't normally spend my life quoting the Gospel. There is a passage in the Gospel which doesn't say the culture will be moderately disagreeable for you. It says, the world will despise you on my account. And, you know, Christianity has been pretty comfortable in the West for a long time now. It's going to be a lot less comfortable. And a lot of Christian leaders are very, very, very fine people, but they find the whole business of controversy rather disconcerting. You know, 30 or 40 years ago, ASIO had to teach its officers how to get involved in a bit of fisticuffs in case such a thing ever happened to them. They're not police enforcement officers, but if you've never been in a brawl, it's much more disconcerting to you than if you have been in one. Well, there's an analogy with controversy, really. If you've never been criticised in the press, it's very, very disconcerting the first time it happens. But if you get criticised,
I thought you were going to advocate papal leadership to get into a brawl, and I would watch that video.
Well, a metaphoric brawl.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think you've got to be a brawler. I say at the end, they've got to be warriors as tough as their opponents, but much nicer. We've got to be happy warriors. Kind hearts, but tough exteriors.
Greg Sheridan, author of God Is Good For You. It's available from Booktopia. It's available from all good bookstores, and it's coming from Allen and Unwin Publishing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, we're now welcome back to the show. Editor of the IPA Review, Scott Hargraves. Welcome back.
Thank you, James. Pleased to be here.
Has not been on for a long time, Scott, so it's great to get him
no,
back.
No, I wondered what I'd said the last time. You know, I thought it was a great interview.
No,
right?
No,
I had like fun, but I haven't heard from you guys.
No,
for
it's
months.
Like a volcano. It's building up, and then it's just going to explode into the electric interview. So let's talk about it. So the IPA Review, it's about to hit mailboxes next week, I think it is.
Correct.
We've got a very cool edition. I'm holding it in my hand. So on the cover is the Four Horsemen of the Modern Apocalypse: Jordan Peterson, Ben Shapiro, Dave Rubin, Eric Weinstein. Now, they're not contributing to this one, but it is sort of the intellectual dark web edition of the IPA Review. So that's sort of the lead off we'll talk about from there. So of those four thinkers, and it also gets into Joe Rogan, Claire Lemon, who's your favorite? intellectual dark web member.
Yeah, I think everyone's got their favourite. In this case, I think it's Eric Weinstein, because he actually coined the phrase the intellectual dark web, this sort of loose community of people who buck the mainstream thought and particularly work through digital media. So he is managing director of Thiel Capital, Peter Thiel himself being a libertarian, and Eric Weinstein's a mathematician, ferociously smart. I was lucky enough to see him on stage in Sydney a little while ago. And, yeah, so he's probably my personal fave.
Any particular things in that Sydney thing or what really attracted you to Eric?
Again, it's so Gideon Rosner's done this piece, and it really is about conversations that you don't get in the mainstream media. It's taking advantage of YouTube, of podcasts. It's using, say, Patreon so that they've actually got funding streams, and it's growing all the time. And some of the the number that you'll see on the image that we've mocked up on the cover is that this Rubin Report interview with these guys, Ben Shapiro, Jordan Peterson, and Eric Weinstein being interviewed by Dave Rubin, has had over 1 million views, and that's quite typical. This is a real phenomenon. And I think Weinstein's sort of like the philosopher of the intellectual dark web.
Yeah, it's crazy how many views they get. Like Pete and I's brief foray into the intellectual dark web interviewing Douglas Murray is now like the IPA's third most watched video on YouTube. Sorry, Peter interrupted.
No.
Okay, there we go.
Yeah, you guys should be part of it, like officially. Although it's sort of an unofficial thing, so I don't know how you actually apply.
Yeah, last week on the show we established that Bella was a member of the intellectual dark web after she got retweeted by Jordan Peterson.
Yeah, I listened to that interview. Great interview.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
So thank you. I wanted to ask about this piece, one more question. Is there a reason you chose Gideon Rosner? He's quite a subversive, some would even say underworld type figure. Is that why you chose him to write this particular piece?
Yeah, well, that's right. He's actually not bad on the mainstream media, so maybe this isn't his natural home, but he is fascinated by it. He's fascinated by how you reach people, and of course the ideas that they're putting across. You know, as you say, this is one place where you can go for classical liberal ideas, libertarian ideas, conservative ideas in a way that you can't anywhere else, and certainly not at length. These 3-hour podcasts and people like Joe Rogan now providing forums for all kinds of discussions, long discussions that you just don't get anywhere else. That's what fascinated Gideon, and he's a great writer.
And, of course, very popular for young people.
Oh, yes. And so Gideon's article closes, indeed, with a high school student that he'd been talking to, where it's almost become a club at this young man's school where these things are shared around the podcast. And but whenever they try to do anything official at the school, it's shut down by the principal. So they have to. It's like hiding a packet of cigarettes down the bottom of the school bag. You know, you got Jordan Peterson podcast instead.
Yeah, very cool. The other thing I want to get into with this one is that it really delved into the power that Colette has. Now, we've had, Chris Berg interviewed Claire Lehrman, who's the editor of Colette, on the show a few months ago. What do you think is the reason that Colette has taken off so quickly?
Well, it actually proved what Claire Lehman thought, which was that there just was nowhere where ideas that were scientifically rigorous, that might challenge the orthodoxy, didn't hew to the relativist line that you see in humanities faculties. She said, I don't see this anywhere, so I'm going to have to do it myself. There must be a market for it, and it's just exploded. And as you say, Bella's article on it got retweeted, but she's now hiring columnists. She's got editors in different countries, and it's a bit like the old Roger Ailes line about Fox News in the US, when he started it for Rupert Murdoch, and someone said to him, "Yeah, gee, Roger, you found a real niche there." And he said, "Yeah, I think it's half of the American population." So it's a bit like that with Quillette. It was just something waiting to happen, and of course the technology's there for it now.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll move on to the next article. So we also have Simon Breeny in the IPA Review, and he's got this blistering takedown of Malcolm Turnbull and talking about all the problems that beset Turnbull in his time as leader. So he runs through freedom of speech, red tape, all of these different things. What do you think was the central reason that Turnbull lost the backing of the party?
The central thesis that Simon has is that, and the standard by which he measured Turnbull in his evaluation, which I think was very fair and balanced, was that it was actually Turnbull's own standards that he'd set for himself. It was going to be a cabinet government. It was going to be a thoroughly liberal government. And as Simon says, he didn't meet his own tests. He did make some forays. Simon gives him credit for at least attempting to reform 18C and actually do something for the advancement of freedom of speech in Australia. Wasn't able to get it through the Senate, but at least he had an attempt, which is more than previous Liberal governments had done. So some credit is due to Turnbull there, but he didn't live up to his own standards, and there was sort of a lack of ambition. So this feeling that, well, the Senate's there and maybe we won't get it through, so we won't try. And if you don't try, you're never going to succeed. And I think that's the thing that really got Simon's goat ultimately, that he can't, but the Turnbull government was never ambitious enough to set a strong agenda. And if he can't get it all through the parliament, so be it. But for goodness sake, have a go.
And does he offer any advice for Morrison?
No, there's not so much in this. In my editorial, actually, I was very interested in Morrison saying that he didn't want a culture war, but he was very interested in doing something about protection of religious freedom.
Okay.
And I actually said, well, good luck with that. It's one or the other.
That's right.
If you're going to do something about religious freedom, you're going to get a culture war straight away.
Exactly. Absolutely. Freedom of speech as well, of course, linked to that.
That's right. You can't protect freedom of religion without protecting freedom of speech.
Not at all. All right, so we move on. So we're flying through them, but there's so much in this IPA review and this interview.
Which will be in the mailboxes for members of the IPA next week.
Very cool. So we'll move on to another one. So we have this article on nuclear energy by Ben Hurd, who's the executive director of the Bright New World. So talking about nuclear power, talking about Australia's energy problems, how do we get in touch with this guy? Because he's not affiliated with the IPA.
That's right. Ben is an eco-modernist and very much concerned about climate change. Eco-modernists are people who believe that technology can solve the world's problems. And for Ben, he sees climate change as a problem. But he presented at the Friedman Conference, the Australia Taxpayers Alliance Conference, that is held every year, that was in Sydney a few months ago. Excellent presentation. He's got a PhD in engineering. Very bright bloke. Comes across really well. So I had the pleasure of meeting him and reached out and said, look, we'll park climate change for the moment, but if that is the problem, then why wouldn't we be looking at nuclear? And that's exactly what he's saying. It's particularly when there are so many leading edge technologies like small-scale nuclear reactors that are being developed all over the world, that it's madness that Australia's turning its back on it.
From an editorial point of view, that's interesting, that kind of technology can help fix the environment. And I've been sort of going on recently about, not going on, speaking with insight and wisdom about how...
somewhere in between the two. Yeah. The truth lies somewhere in between.
About how free markets are the best form of protecting the environment. Is that one of the reasons why you got him to write this? Someone who's actually quite concerned about the environment and thinks that technology is a good way to fix it.
Exactly. I mean, you can be. There's just so much catastrophism around, and particularly, climate change is rife with it. And it's you go from catastrophism and then sort of technological boondoggles. You know, Snowy 2.0 and wind and solar and all these rubbish technologies. Whereas actual real existing technology that can do stuff get pushed to the back of the queue. So, yes, you do have to have an optimistic view of the future. Humanity's capacity to create technologies to solve social and environmental problems is stupendous if you let it happen.
Yep. Absolutely. Push forward rather than roll everything back.
Yeah, so nuclear's always been a bit of a no-brainer for me. Like, I've never quite understood why Australia doesn't pursue it because, there's all the scaremongering that happens after what happened in Japan, but it's not as if outback South Australia is ever going to be hit by an earthquake and a tsunami simultaneously. So what is holding back nuclear power in Australia?
Part of it is scaremongering and catastrophism. It was also historically the case for a long time that we had a very economically competitive coal-fired electricity base. our baseload power, so perhaps there wasn't the market opportunity for nuclear there. But with renewable energies being shoved into the market, that's destroyed the economics of coal-fired power stations. As Ben explains, you know, unless governments act, all these baseload power stations will come offline and we will be in the proverbial. So some people might say, well, the answer is high-efficiency coal, and that's fair enough. But Ben's saying, no, have a look at this nuclear stuff and just put away all those preconceptions about safety, which are rubbish, blah, blah, blah. So it's a very good piece.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's stupid because we export so much uranium. So it's not like we can't think it's that dangerous.
Yeah, he said if Australia was a patient, it'd be on the therapist's couch. You're happy to export, dig it up and export it, but you're not happy to use it to make electricity.
That's right.
All right, good analogy. All right, so move on to another one. So we have Darcy Allen talking about red tape. Now, red tape is a central central concept to the IPA's work last couple of years. What's new from this article about red tape in Australia?
Well, that's the perfect question, James.
Thank you.
I actually thought of that one.
No, I believe it was me, actually. So anything Pete says to the contrary is outright lies.
Very good. Because Darcy's actually traced the evolution of thinking about red tape. We know red tape's a problem. You know, the growth in government, the growth in stupid rules that are holding back individuals and businesses has been identified as a problem for decades. But it's about what are the tools that you can actually use to do something about it. The IPA has certainly been doing this for years, fighting the good fight, and you've seen the IPA videos where we've had the pages of legislation that have been added in a year, and the and there's a photo in here of Trump doing the same thing in the US.
Solar idea.
Yeah, look at all these pages. And that is certainly not a bad rule of thumb in terms of how many pages of legislation governments pass. But Darcy's talking about the latest techniques, which is an organisation in the US, the Mercatus Center, using what they call reg data, which is where you actually count up all the regulatory restrictions. James Patterson explained this on last week's podcast.
Indeed.
Better than I possibly could, actually. But Darcy in this article, it's a good companion piece, traces all that this is the way that you can measure and benchmark and then drive real reductions. He points out that Campbell Newman started this in Queensland, but unfortunately was thrown out of office after only one term, and along with it, his red tape reduction program, an absolute tragedy for Queensland.
Absolutely. So my next question was going to be, so what was it like for you as an editor to have Darcy Allen talk about something that isn't blockchain? Because that's something no one's been able to crack for years.
Yeah, well, he tried to get it in there. I just kept crossing it out. Every time there was a draft, it was back in there. But no.
Yeah, Control-F blockchain, Darcy. You're going to have to try again.
Crypto something.
Cool.
Crypto
sorry.
Red tape.
Yeah, yeah. So the last one we're going to talk about here is a really fascinating article by a high school student in Melbourne. So he's talking about the effects that Stalin had on Russia, and he uses his own great-grandparents' story to tell that story. So first off, how did we get in touch with this student?
Maxim actually approached a friend of the IPA and had this piece and was interested in getting it published. Then referred to us, and he was quite happy to have it published here. He's a lover of freedom, certainly whatever nonsense they might be talking about communism at school, when he can talk to his own great grandparents and his own grandparents about life under Stalin, then he's under no illusions. So it's a piece he'd already written, but we're proud to publish it because this is something young people especially need to know more about.
Especially, yeah.
And so you're 11 student, is that correct?
Yes, at the Maxim Bishev from the John Monash Science School in Melbourne.
All right, cool. And in particular, it's about intellectual life under Stalin, is that correct?
Yes. So the fact that, you know, the Communist Party would have people in every organisation to make sure that everyone was hewing to the line. And in a way, the headline, and this is a line from his grandfather, that you're rewarded for not thinking.
Yeah, okay.
The party didn't want you to think about anything. So here are his great-grandparents at the university in Leningrad, as it was then, St. Petersburg, which is supposed to be a place of intellectual inquiry, but in fact that's the opposite of what the party actually wants you to do. Mm-hmm. So it's this, they just want you to repeat the stories about how great the Soviet state is and how great Stalin is and so on and so forth.
And do these elderly people, do they see, I wouldn't say comparisons, but like similarities with a lack of intellectual inquiry in Australia today in our academic life? Or?
I don't know that, that they may well. That's not really where the article's coming from, but certainly there's a. It closes with a quote that Maxim got from his great-grandmother, Anya, about just the importance of thinking for yourself,
mm-hmm.
That there are all these forces which that lie about communism, but also it's about closing down thought processes. So it really is a very inspirational passage, I think, about the importance of thinking for yourself and free thought.
Yeah, was there any one particular part of that story that really stood out for you, or maybe like an example of them not being able to think for themselves?
Well, there's a story of his grandfather who got invited in for a chat.
Yeah.
and for some of the things that he'd said when he was at university in the 70s under the Brezhnev regime in Soviet Russia. And it was a polite chat, but underneath it all was, well, this is a polite chat, but you better do what we say, because otherwise the next time we're talking about this stuff, it won't be so pleasant. Mm. So there's just it's the threat of violence that's underlying it all.
Absolutely.
And that is a powerful passage.
Yeah. So one thing that sometimes gets said about Stalin, especially by young people, is the idea that like under his regime or under the regimes around him, that wasn't true socialism. That was just totalitarianism. If we tried true socialism, it would work. So after reading that, and you know, you've got a wealth of knowledge about 20th century Russia, what would you say to students or anyone who thinks Stalin wasn't real socialism?
Well, Maxim's very good on this. He's clearly thought a lot about this. So for instance, the underlying idea is equity and equality, and that can only be enforced through violence, essentially. So, as he says here, I think it was his grandfather who observed, well, we had equality. Everyone was equally poor, equally unfree. Equally sort of under the yoke. So that is the central proposition of Marxism, is that there has to be absolute equality. Well, this is what you get. You can't say that's not true communism, because that's true communism being practiced.
Brilliant. Scott Hargraves, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you to Greg Sheridan and Scott Hargraves for those interviews. Now, we are very late in the show, but we did think these stories were very funny, so we do want to share them with our listeners.
Completely different pitch to the last couple of interviews.
Yes. So, you know, listeners, you've been with us for nearly an hour now, maybe over an hour. Hopefully you'll stick around.
Thinking about the nature of the universe.
Yes. So let's loosen up. Let's undo the ties. Pete and I have never worn a tie. I'm wearing a t-shirt
except
right
the
now.
Cord. Just a joke. Just a joke.
Yeah. So let's have some fun with it. So, I like this story. Out of Chesapeake, which has already piqued my interest because that's a funny name for a town. Out of Chesapeake in the USA, if you want a trick or treat, I've got some bad news for you. Mm. You're gonna have a nasty treat, maybe a trick. There's a new law in Chesapeake that prohibits anyone over the age of 12 from engaging in the activity commonly known as trick or treat. Those who break the law are guilty of a misdemeanor and could face a fine of $25 or up to 6 months in jail.
That's ridiculous.
Like trick, treat, or criminal conviction.
How's it like? $25, it's like, okay, that's something a 13-year-old could pay. Yep. Or 6 months in the slammer.
Or 6 months in slammer, all right? So good luck getting to that sleepover, because you're going to be in jail.
Yeah. Now, this triggered Nina, apparently.
I got triggered by this.
Okay. Last week got spicy when Nina started cutting six, so.
Yeah.
This one's triggered me a bit, because trick or treat for how... was that Halloween?
That's mm-hmm. correct.
It's for kids, right? Yeah. Kids to enjoy the holiday. Like, they go to houses, knock on doors, and get candies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
And I...
Do you still trick or treat?
No, but, like, I want to do that. Like, we can't do it here. Just because no one's going to open the door. I don't know why. Anyway, I love that. Like, I want to do that. And personally, I'm beyond 12. Okay. I don't want to get fined or jailed just because I want for some free candies.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous.
Nor should you.
Why?
I'm glad we're not. Wait.
So when people just forcing others to become adult in early stage of life.
Nina's like pointing at me and yelling. Yeah. I didn't make the law, Nina.
Yeah.
I don't see why the government hates trick-or-treating, though.
Yeah.
Because what trick-or-treating is going to someone's house and taking something from them that they don't want to give you. Like, what is more government than that?
Yeah, that's quite good, Jan.
Thank you.
Very sharp.
Thank you.
That's highbrow.
Thank you. Oh, yeah. I forgot. We were going broad lowbrow. Yeah. trick-or-treating, good.
Don't let it happen again. So I think the other thing is it's other places as well. And also, if you're 10 or 11, you can't trick-or-treat without adult supervision. So there's laws for the people under 12 as well. Halloween in general is stuff though, because think about all the costumes and stuff they wear to the costume parties later, like the college kids.
Yeah.
That's cultural appropriation.
Yeah, don't want to appropriate Frankenstein.
So, you know, they're just ruining
Halloween. It's got a strong culture, Nina.
Oh, yeah, true.
Yeah. All right. Well,
cool.
Nina went nuts again.
Yep. And we're all just recovering from that. Pete, let's talk about Winston Churchill.
Well, if Nina was triggered just then, I am triggered, because I love Winston Churchill. He's probably my favourite political figure. And an astronaut, Scott Kelly, has a lot of followers, very, very popular person in the United States, was criticising the Republicans for carrying on after they won the Kavanaugh issue. And he tweeted, one of the greatest leaders of modern times, Sir Winston Churchill, said in victory, magnanimity. Can you say it?
Magnanimity.
Yep, that's almost
what Nina said.
I guess those days are over. So he's saying, you know, you should be, you know, gracious in victory, which is a fair enough point. Now, you've got an outrage mob. As happens, I don't know if you guys are aware, but outrage mobs happen these days. And he followed up with cowardice when he wrote, "Did not mean to offend by quoting Churchill. My apologies. I will go and educate myself further on his atrocities, racist views, which I do not support. My point was that we need to come together as one nation. We are all Americans. That should transcend partisan politics." Now, James, can you get me a bucket?
Yep.
Because I'm going to spew.
Okay.
It's bad enough for anyone.
Yeah, what's that other Churchill quote that you were talking about yesterday? Oh,
yeah, you know, like his whole
something
thing.
About the beaches and
yeah, the beaches.
Something about surrendering.
Well, yeah, you are a disgrace. And, you know, like never, like, you know, never give in, never, never, never.
Yep.
Like, do it to anyone else, that's fine. It's not fine, but do it to anyone else. But the person who literally, his whole thing is, I'm not going to surrender to people that are wrong.
Yeah.
And you do that. I reckon they did set up the moon landing. This guy, I mean, I don't understand how this guy
like,
got into this
fight. I was going to say, like, if he could withstand G-Force, he can't withstand a Twitter mob. Like, he can't put down his phone for an hour and just go, ugh, I got a bit out of hand.
Yeah, I don't get it. You, what do you think?
I think, I don't know, because, like...
Okay, here we go.
No, because there was a similar story where...
We don't like, speak in German, mate.
No, I'm not defending Scott Kelly, but I'm saying like it'd be weird for someone who's used to just being like, wow, gee, that's an astronaut.
Yeah.
To suddenly have like, oh, like, you know, maybe he's put down his phone, he's picked it up, and there's like 1,000 notifications from Twitter of people calling him endorsing racism. Like that, like I can just see people freaking out at that.
Well, this is what Greg talked about in the interview, didn't he?
Yeah. You're
not used to this kind of controversy.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So maybe, like he shouldn't have done that, but like, I don't know.
Maybe
like throwing coward and stuff like that is, you know, the guy went to outer space, allegedly. Can we become an astronaut skeptic podcast?
Oh,
that would be so much fun.
That's my understanding. No, look, maybe you're right. I shouldn't have called him a coward, but yeah. And I understand how people, maybe I understand a little bit better how people kind of do. But anyway.
I mean, I just love, this is the most highbrow podcast we've ever done. And we've ended on the fact, like, motion carried, motion passed. We no longer believe the moon landing happened.
Yeah. No, well, you know. I'm happy with that. But look, you know, yeah, okay. I think I've made my point.
All right, so third one. talking of fallen heroes, by the way, this is the final story we'll get to. So Jordan Peterson, very famous guy.
Had a bit of a
day on Twitter himself. Tough week for Jordan. Sorry. There was this discussion between some members in the intellectual dark web on Twitter. They're all tweeting at each other, what should happen with Kavanaugh?
Yep.
And Jordan weighed in. If confirmed, which he was, Kavanaugh should step down. The idea being he should resign because he's brought too much attention and bad attention to himself and to the office, that he should do the noble thing and step down and have someone like, you know, Amy Barrett or someone take the place.
Yeah.
Now, Jordan.
Listen in.
Take an e, mate. No, but the point is, like, the intellectual dark web, their whole, well, like, they've got many things, but, like, one of the central things it comes back to is don't give in to outrage mobs, stand your ground, think for yourself, don't get out of...
Have courage.
Like, yeah, yeah, don't, like, we shall fight them on the beaches, I guess. We shall fight them on the internet. For him to say, okay, Kavanaugh should step down as the honourable path, it's like, dude, your whole thing. Like, what makes Kavanaugh different to Brett Weinstein, who stood in, like, against the people at Evergreen College? Like, what are the differences there?
Yeah.
That's my theory.
And wouldn't it just, doesn't that mean that next time, like, his argument is, oh, you know, we need national unity.
Yeah.
And by stepping down after he's been appointed, that would prove.
Yeah.
That would, you know.
Oh, because the next person Trump nominated will have a gilded path. Like, they're not going to go, all right, we need to bring down Amy Barrett as well.
It's weird that he would think that would stop it happening again.
Yeah, I don't get it at all.
And it is a partial admission of guilt. Like, people would read that as an admission of guilt.
Oh, if he stepped down, it'd be like, well, you know.
There you go. Yeah. His conscience got to him. Anyway, I don't know. I also, look, if you agree with sort of 99 of someone's opinions and you disagree with one, you don't throw the baby.
Oh, if Jordan tweeted out Stanley Kubrick faked the moon landings, I'm back on board. Well, that's absolutely true.
Has anyone asked me about that? Maybe we should.
That's his next 3-hour video.
And America is brutally polarized.
The only 3-hour video on the internet about the moon landings.
Yeah, exactly. But we'll be watched by a few more people.
Yeah.
But America is brutally polarised at the moment, so I do see where he's coming from, but disagree.
Yes, exactly. That is it for the show this week. Thank you to Greg Sheridan and Scott Hargraves for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. So make sure you're buying the IPA review. It is only available... Sorry, make sure you're becoming a member if you want that IPA review. Mm. It is only available to IPA members. If you're not an IPA member... you will not read those articles that we were talking about.
You won't get that new review smell.
Oof. Ain't that the thing?
You just might get a few on the net over the coming months.
Yes. Not the same. And maybe not the article. Like, maybe you're like, man, that Stalin article sounded really cool. Mm. You might not be able to read it unless you're an IPA member. Mm. So make sure you're doing that. Thank you to Scott. Make sure you're also going out and buying God Is Good For You. It's available from Allen & Unwin Publishing. It's also on Booktopia. Or awesome if you book. Like a new book smell, you can wander down to any good bookstore and it should be there. So make sure you're doing that as well. Thank you to Greg Sheridan. And thank you all for listening and downloading and subscribing. Available on iTunes, Podbean, Spotify, Pocket Cast, you name it, we're on it. Make sure you're telling your friends and family about the show. And if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you're leaving a 5-star review. They are flooding in at the moment because of the new iOS operating system, making it so easy for people to leave 5-star reviews. So make sure you're doing one of those things. You can also leave a comment, maybe a tip for the show, maybe something you'd like to see, maybe the return of a segment that you want. And Nina, if people want to become an IPA member, if they want that review, what can people do?
Well, just visit their websites where everything's are at the moment. Then click on that join button, and starting as low as $22, you become one of the loudest voices of freedom in Australia with IPA review.
Brilliant. Long show, good show. The moon landings were fake. See you next week.
See ya.